Hello, you are listening to The Sower, a podcast of the Ciceronian Society. This episode is a video and audio recording of the final plenary session from our March 2026 conference in Omaha. It is titled Religious Liberty in the U.S. Today and features three speakers. Paul Mueller of the American Institute for Economic Research introduces the panel and each speaker. John Wilsey of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary delivers his paper, A Theological Defense of Religious Liberty. Longtime listeners will recall that Dr. Wilsey was interviewed on episodes 18, 34, and 75 of The Sower. Then we hear from Mark David Hall of the Center for Religion, Culture, and Democracy. He was interviewed on episode 8 of The Sower, and the CRCD was the subject of episode 16. He and Dr. Mueller then take turns presenting about the 2026 report of the CRCD's Religious Liberty in the States project. Here's the panel. Enjoy.
All right. Well, again, thank you for persisting and coming to this panel. So this panel is on religious liberty, which is an important and a growing topic of conversation. There's been a lot of change and improvement from a religious Christian perspective over the last several years. But that is, you know, the U.S. has a long history with religious liberty. And so I'm excited to be here to present on some work that I've done, with Dr. Mark Hall. And we have John Wilsey here. The fourth member of our panel was not able to stay. Which means you get to hear more from us. Hopefully that's a good thing. So the way we're going to go, it's going to be a little bit unusual. I'm going to have Dr. Wilsey come up first and talk, and then I'm going to invite Mark to come, and then I'll talk, and then Mark will come back up and talk some, because we've got some different parts of our presentation. So let me go ahead and introduce John Wilsey, who probably needs almost no introduction for you all. But should you need an introduction, there's a 2 or 3 page bio on his page at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. The man has written a lot and done a lot. Just to highlight sort of his formal role. So he specializes in the history of American religious nationalism and American conservatism. And his position at Southern Baptist Seminary, he's a professor of church history and philosophy and chair of the Department of Church History and Historical Theology. He's written about Christian nationalism. He had a book about John Foster Dulles that came out just a few years ago. Has written on a variety of topics, both church history, nationalism, Christian nationalism, and a variety of other topics. So I look forward to hearing from him. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Wilsey.
Thank you, Paul, and thank you to the Ciceronian Society for allowing me to be on this panel. It's great to be with you. Finbar Curtis opens his 2016 book entitled The Production of American Religious Freedom with this provocative statement. There is no such thing as religious freedom, or at least not one thing. Americans, Curtis argues, reflexively assume that persons are free to choose their religious belief system and that this freedom is self-evidently given by God. And he questions this foundational assumption by analyzing 8 historical milieus in which distinct concepts of religious freedom arose. In short, I see that you're on the edge of your seat, Curtis argues that religious freedom has been produced over a long period of time in the context of conflict between private and public interests. Ultimately, the question of American religious freedom historically has been directly related to the allocation of what he calls contested and finite social resources in American life and the governance necessary to that allocation. He offers 8 historical case studies in his book to examine how he says, how freedom has been contested, challenged, and transformed. On numerous occasions throughout the book, he describes religious freedom as a malleable rhetorical device that has been used in various contexts not to eliminate constraints on religion and religious practice, but to allocate finite social resources. His 8 case studies, he attempts to illustrate that dynamic. For example, Charles Finney's Revivalism shows how social pressures serve to manipulate the individual will in an effort to make converts. He points out Al Smith, who divorced religious freedom from the individual conscience, seeing it as, quote, not a personal autonomy free from all institutional constraints, but establishing a neutral public square free from particular religious prejudices and endorsements. He includes Louisa May Alcott, William Jennings Bryan, D.W. Griffith, Malcolm X, Intelligent Design Movement, to examine how freedom is a subjective concept, useful for any array of social and economic, political and religious projects. His last study in his book is the Burwell versus Hobby Lobby case, in which religious freedom became, in his words, a device for the advancement of the notion of the personhood of corporations. Freedom is recognizable, quote, when the government leaves citizens, embryos, and corporations alone to do what they wish with their money. So he wants to persuade his readers that religious freedom has never been a thing in itself in American life, but it's historically contingent. And this argument puts Curtis's work in an interesting conversation with the book Persecution and Toleration, The Long Road to Religious Freedom by Noel Johnson and Mark Koyama, which also underscores the historical contingency of religious freedom, although from a political rather than a social or an economic perspective. Curtis's work is, a sophisticated analysis of disparate historical contexts in which Americans have mediated religious freedom over time. But his historical considerations begin far too late. While Curtis clearly sees that his book is not a history of religious freedom, he does call on at least some of that history to make his argument. He goes back to the Second Great Awakening for his starting point. Why is that? Why is Curtis's first case study in the context of the Second Awakening, when religious pluralism existed in English-speaking America long before the 19th century? How would Curtis have brought the earlier English-speaking history of religious freedom into his analysis? What roles would American figures, going back to Roger Williams, have played in Curtis's study? Would the natural theological justifications consistently provided by earlier American thinkers until the 1780s have affected the way Curtis understands the role religious freedom has played in America that is much older than a couple of hundred years? Curtis mentions Stephen Smith's book, The Rise and Decline of American Religious Freedom, on this important point, but he minimizes the significance of a key argument that Smith makes, that religious justifications were consistently present prior to 1790 and are also necessary to any articulation of religious freedom, so defining it in objective terms, not subjective terms. If, as Curtis argues, religious freedom has been produced since the 19th century, it's largely then because religious freedom has been untethered from theology. Alexis de Tocqueville observed that in America, religion was necessary for the preservation of liberty in the face of despotic tendencies in an equally conditioned society. And Tocqueville's famous point of departure in democracy in America was the Pilgrim and the Puritan founding of New England and the singular form of Christianity these colonial founders brought with them to American shores. He described this brand of Christianity as democratic and republican and in accord with politics from the moment of colonial inception to the moment of Tocqueville's writing. While there is no federally established religion in America, Tocqueville argued that religion was indispensable to American political and social life. He famously said, "Religion must be considered as the first of their political institutions." It was essential to freedom because freedom was not possible without a consensus on morality. And where did morality come from? It came from Christianity. And because of this, Tocqueville could say, if religion does not give them the taste for liberty, it singularly facilitates their use of it. Americans so closely regarded religion's necessity to freedom that they often conflated the two. And furthermore, Tocqueville was astonished to find that disestablished religion's power was so great that Americans saw the need to preserve religion as a bulwark for Republican institutions in the settled Eastern states for the sake of emerging American civilization in the Western states and territories where those institutions were fragile. Americans thus perceived a duty to protect the rights and freedoms of others in order to protect their own, and protecting freedom meant protecting religion. So importantly, for Tocqueville, religion was simultaneously a product and creator of free institutions and behaviors in America. And specifically, religion was reflected in Americans' public spirit, that patriotism in which public and private interest were merged through active citizenship on the local level, in contrast with Finbar Curtis's thesis that public and private interests are in a necessary conflict with one another. Tocqueville saw that religion was born out of political and civic associations, those uniquely American institutions that arose out of an awareness from birth of the necessity of self-reliance rather than on reliance on distant governmental jurisdictions to solve practical problems. Americans formed associations, as Tocqueville said, for purposes of public security, commerce and industry, morality and religion. And of course, the doctrine of self-interest, well understood, meant that every American understood how and when to make small sacrifices for the good of the whole. Now, while Tocqueville acknowledged this doctrine did not make for a virtuous society, it did make for an ordered and self-controlled one. And order was a virtue learned first in the home, where religion fundamentally informed the mores, the basic intellectual and moral character of the people, and the mores, the laws. Now, if Tocqueville was correct that religion is necessary to liberty, then it must be true that religious liberty has a theological basis. And if religious freedom has a theological basis, then it cannot be true that religious liberty is produced over time in the context of conflicts between public and private interests. Theological justifications for religious freedom can be traced back to the teachings of Christ. In Mark 12:17, we see Christ recognizing the distinction between civil and spiritual authority. That is, render to God the things that are, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, to God the things that are God's. The early apologists, Justin Martyr, Athenagoras, appealed to Caesar to argue that Christians ought to be granted toleration because they were innocent of the charges of atheism and incest, and because they worshiped the one true God. Tertullian argued that the freedom to follow one's religious convictions, he called it a fundamental right, and furthermore that God, quote, has appointed an eternal judgment, when both thankful and unthankful will have to stand before his bar. Time does not permit us to discuss the contributions made by Lactantius in the Edict of Milan, which granted toleration to Christians for the first time in 313, or those of medieval thinkers such as Marsilius of Padua, Thomas Aquinas, or Erasmus. The Reformation, with its emphasis on the individual soul before God, gave religious freedom a new intellectual context in which to flourish. John Witte described the Reformation as, quote, at its core, a fight for religious liberty, liberty of the individual conscience from intrusive canon laws and clerical controls, liberty of political officials from ecclesiastical power and privilege, liberty of the local clergy from central papal rule and oppressive princely controls. The common thread in the method of arguing for religious toleration and freedom from the first century to the Reformation to the American founding was the reality of two things: the existence of God and the individual's accountability before God. As Gregory Wallace said, the theological argument for religious freedom did not depend on the subjective value of religion, but it ultimately is based on the plausibility of the essential claim of religion, that God exists. These common threads remained in the English-speaking world after 1600. The first Baptist in the English-speaking world, Thomas Helwys, made the first case in England for full religious freedom to James I in 1612 in his treatise, which has the best title ever, A Short Declaration of the Mystery of Iniquity. Helwys did not argue for mere toleration for Christians who dissented. He argued for full religious freedom for everyone without distinction for their religious convictions. Helwys wrote, For men's religion to God is between God and themselves. The king will not answer for it. Neither may the king be the judge between God and man. Let them be heretics, Turks, Jews, or whatsoever. It does not appertain to the earthly power to punish them in the least measure. This is the first argument of its kind in the English language. After reading Helwys's treatise, James had Helwys thrown into Newgate Prison, and he died there in 1616. But in the American experience, luminaries like John Locke and Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, George Washington, and others all presuppose God's existence and human accountability in their arguments for religious freedom. And as Nicholas Miller has demonstrated in his work, the dissenting tradition represented by Baptists, Methodists, Quakers, led their arguments for religious freedom with the idea that God the Creator was the author of spiritual and political liberty. Modernity, in its consistently articulated reaction to medieval scholasticism, from Occam's denial of universals to Descartes' divorce of metaphysics and epistemology, to Hume's denial that religion counted as knowledge, to John Dixon White's declaration of war between religion and science, to Anthony Fauci's announcement that he is the science. Modernity has taught us to alienate special revelation from general revelation, the spiritual from the physical, the universal from the particular. But to secure the tradition of religious freedom and hand it down unsullied to our children and grandchildren, we can and must recover theology in our stewardship of religious freedom. God defend the right. Thank you.
So I'm going to invite Mark up. Again, many of you probably know Dr. Mark Hall, but he taught at George Fox for many years and still has an affiliation there. In the last 3 to 5 years, he's been teaching at Regent in the law program there. Mark has a long history both of studying the American founding, but also has served as an expert witness in many religious liberty cases around displays of the Ten Commandments or school choice or other kinds of issues as well. So he's going to come up and kind of frame the general project that's on the table in front of you, the Religious Liberty in the States project, and sort of why we're doing this project, how it relates to kind of the high-level congressional and federal statutes. Then I'll go through some of the details of it, and then I'll invite Mark back up to kind of talk about where the project's going and some of its implications. But with that, please join me in welcoming Dr. Mark Hall.
Well, thank you, Paul, and thank you all for having me. I've become an absolute evangelist for the Ciceronian Society. When I see my friends who should come here, maybe not all academics should come here, but those who should, I say, this has got to be your conference. It is so much more rewarding than the old American Political Science Association conference that I used to go to decades ago. I just love this. So we thought it might be useful to set the stage for why religious liberty in the States. Because many people, I know we have some lawyers and law professors and judges here who don't need to hear what I have to say, but I think for many Americans, when they think religious liberty, they immediately think of the First Amendment, right? Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Well, we have this First Amendment, so, you know, why don't we just go there to protect the ability of Americans to believe whatever they want, to worship however they want, and very significantly to act upon their religious convictions whenever possible. There has to be a limiting principle, and we can discuss that later if you would like. Well, we do have the First Amendment, but there's a couple of problems with relying on the First Amendment. To begin with, the First Amendment did not applied to the states until 1940. And so prior to 1940, if religious liberty is to be protected in most contexts, not the federal territories, but in most contexts, it's up to states to protect them. And states did. As Americans revised their constitutions after or during the War for American Independence, every new constitution had religious liberty provision. The two states that did not pass religious liberty statutes. And these were pretty robust, really, in the scheme of things. Well, finally, 1940, the First Amendment applies to the states, but you still have the question of what does the First Amendment protect? There were a couple of earlier cases, and the Supreme Court in the 19th century said basically it protects belief. You get to believe whatever you want, but if you act on that belief in such a way as to violate a law, bam, off to jail or whatever other penalty there might be. And so the state of Washington recently kind of tried to do something like this. So Catholic priests might believe in the sanctity of the seal of confession, but if he acts on that in certain contexts, bam, he's going to get thrown into jail. So again, this kind of belief action doctrine is still alive and well. Believe it or not, in the mid to late 20th century, all Americans, it seems, understood religious liberty. A very progressive justice, William Brennan, came up with a really fine test for interpreting the Free Exercise Clause. Basically, he said if there is a religious conviction and the state wants to somehow override it, the state has to show a compelling interest, a really, really important reason for doing so, and it has to do so in the least intrusive means possible. So this is a really nice test to protect religious liberty. And again, this is William Brennan, the progressive, who thought this was a good idea, and other justices joined him. Unfortunately, from my perspective, one of my favorite justices in a 1990 case, along with other justices, said, yeah, let's get rid of that test and more or less kind of move back to this belief action test. As long as the law is general and neutral and of general applicability, it's okay. And so if you have a law that says no one gets to use peyote in a state, well, if you have Native Americans who have a religious conviction to do so, too bad for them. Now, Scalia was clear states could protect the ability of Native Americans to use peyote if they wanted to, but they didn't have to. All right, so while this is 1990, in the late 20th century, Americans could come together to protect religious liberty, and they did. Democrats and Republicans came together to pass the Religious Freedom Restoration Act in 1993, 97-3 in the Senate, unanimous by voice vote in the House, and it was signed into law by President Bill Clinton. And basically, this law was intended to return to this older standard, this William Brennan standard. So Democrats and Republicans could come together to protect religious liberty. Well, that's kind of cool. But unfortunately, 1997, the U.S. Supreme Court said basically, when it comes to the states, you can't tell federal courts what the First Amendment means. So if Religious Freedom Restoration Act unconstitutional with respect to the states, it's still binding upon Congress, and that's important. But still, that means within the states, what states do to protect religious liberty remains important. And it has become particularly important as we get into the 21st century. I don't want to seem too partisan, but I think it's accurate to say that the political left has abandoned religious liberty. Not altogether. They still probably want to protect the ability of Native Americans to use peyote in religious ceremonies, as do I. But when it comes to LGBTQ issues, when it comes to issues of life and death, I'm thinking of abortion, euthanasia, and so forth, what we have seen is a turn away from religious liberty. And again, because the First Amendment is currently in the recent court has done a better job of interpreting the First Amendment, but still Employment Division versus Smith hasn't been overturned. So what states do can have a tremendously important impact on protecting what many founders called the sacred rights of conscience. And so that's all to set up why states matter. You all don't need to know that. You already know that. But believe me, in this area of law, they particularly matter. And so Paul will lead us into our study, which explains how we attempt to get out what states do and how well they protect religious liberty.
All right. So thank you, Mark, for setting that up. All right. So this project started a number of years ago. We're in our fifth year. The 2026 study will be coming out this summer. So you have copies of 2025 in front of you. I'm going to show you some data from 2025. But as Mark mentioned, let me get my notes here. There's lots of reasons why state protections matter. And just to highlight a few, state protections matter where federal protections are either non-existent or ambiguous. And state protections matter even where the general state legislature might be favorable to religious liberty. So you might think, well, you want religious protections in Washington State or California or Illinois because you have a hostile legislature or you have sort of this hostile culture. But even in red states, even in a place like Texas, you might want state protections to keep magistrates in Austin from doing crazy things, right? So you might want state-level protections to prevent the overruling of religious freedom in municipalities or in counties. So there's a number of things here, but let me just show a few things here. So this is the map from last year. What's interesting about the index is it's not precisely a red state, blue state story. So you can see here the blue states, the dark blue are the better ones. Illinois is on here. Washington is on here, kind of surprising. Of course, you have Florida was number one last year. Montana was number two. Those are more red states. And then if you look at the states that have the least protections, the orange, you have Nebraska, where we are now, West Virginia, Wyoming are on there. So it's not specifically a red-blue state kind of issue. And part of the argument we want to make, so this is a study, so there's an academic element to it, but there's also a policy statement here that we try to talk with state legislatures and make the case that particularly conservative or Republican state legislatures should think seriously about passing religious protections that they don't have. And so you might say, well, West Virginia, we're, you know, very Republican. We don't really need this. I just mentioned the issue of you might have localities that are not so conservative. But let me give you another story. And we've written about this in the past. I'm from Colorado. Okay. You can see Colorado's kind of middle of the pack there. This light green 34 last year. I grew up in Colorado sort of in the 90s and the early 2000s. It was a red state. Had red legislature, red governor, focused on the family, evangelical all over Colorado Springs, and they didn't really pass any religious liberty protections. And now it's a blue state. And let me tell you, the idea of getting new religious liberty protections passed is a bit of a pipe dream, not happening in the foreseeable future. And there's a lot of bad stuff that's been going on in Colorado that could have been mitigated if they had passed more religious liberty protections when the sun was shining. Now, you contrast that with, say, Illinois. So for several years of our study, Illinois was actually the top, in terms of our index, the top state, which is very surprising. A lot of people were skeptical of our study. How could you have a liberal blue state be at the top? Well, we dug into this. We had a law student who helped with this as well. If you look at Illinois, they passed a lot of religious liberty protections back in the late 80s and the early 90s when there was a stronger pro-life Catholic presence on the Democratic side, and it was more there were more Republicans there. So there was more friendliness towards religious liberty in the 80s and the early 90s, so that Illinois, even though it hasn't done anything recently, was still a relatively has many protections on the book, especially medical protections. Now, a part of the index that is interesting is we constantly add to it as we find new ways that states are trying to protect religious liberty. There's all kinds of new ways in which religious liberty is threatened. Mark alluded to the LGBTQ issues. Those continue to multiply. They affect foster, like whether you can qualify as foster parents. They affect whether you can opt out of school curriculum. They affect even if you're, there's a case in Colorado right now, I don't know if it's before the Supreme Court or just one of the federal courts, of a counselor who doesn't want to counsel someone in their gender identity dysphoria and is like suggesting they go somewhere else and has been sued for some kind of discrimination against the LGBTQ person because they won't, you know, affirm gender identity kind of issues. And so it continues to multiply. Churches or houses of worship being kept open during pandemics. That was not an issue pre-2020, and now it is. And so states, one of the things we measure is have states protected houses of worship in a similar way to other public gatherings, whether that's casinos, restaurants, and so forth. So that is, it's a growing index. And what's interesting is over time, this will become probably more of a red-blue divide as red states are more sympathetic and aware of threats to religious liberty. They're trying to plug those gaps. Illinois, not as interested in adding new things. And so one thing we've seen is Illinois' score has declined as we've added more new items that they have not added. So this is the kind of the broad map there. Within the folder you have or the report there, we have the 50 states listed here. The top five last year, you can see Florida, Montana, Illinois, Ohio, Mississippi, the bottom five there. Most improved, we had Montana, South Carolina, and Florida had significant improvement going on here. So again, this was last year. The way that this report is set up, just in terms of the structure, is we have five kind of broad categories in terms of how we group our protections. We look at 50 distinct protections in this year. So there's like distinct pieces of legislation or items that we check and see, okay, does a state have this protection or not? We group those into safeguards because many of them are related. So for example, there's five or six different types of protection around abortion. So there's individual provider protections, there's private hospital, there's public hospital, there's in case of emergency. And so we kind of group that all together under a safeguard around religious exemptions for performing abortions because we don't want to overweight that category too much. So there's a lot. This is an index with a weighting that goes on here. So I just want to walk through some of the broad safeguards. These are sort of the 20 categories that we look at, and many of these have two or three or four items underneath them. One of the most important categories is the RFRAs, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, that Mark alluded to. He was talking about the federal one, but states have been implementing RFRAs. This is generally more of an umbrella kind of protection. It's broad often, but it also can be interpreted in various ways by state courts. Absentee voting, being able to vote when election days fall on holidays, religious holidays, having that option is why we have that. Public official recusal from performing same-sex marriage or other things that they object to, if that's possible. So we've got some government-related safeguards. Healthcare safeguards are kind of the biggest one and the longest standing one because there are so many kinds of religious concerns when it comes to the medical profession and the kinds of operations you perform or services you provide. So states can have a general conscience provision, and sometimes that covers a lot of things. Sometimes it's a little bit narrower. We focus on abortion, sterilization, which is a lot of LGBTQ kind of related hormone therapy and surgeries, contraception refusal, euthanasia, recusal for counseling providers, and then health insurance mandates. Are health insurance companies required to provide certain kinds of services or coverage that they object to? So this is our healthcare safeguards here. Increasingly, we're adding economic life safeguards. And so this is kind of what Mark was talking about, that divide between belief and action. And so when we think about religious liberty, we want to have a very robust understanding of it, that what we believe should affect what we do, and what we do is related to what we believe. And so companies ought not to be obligated, or sole proprietors ought not to be obligated to engage in activities that they have sincere religious objections to. So you can think about Master Cake Shop and Jack Phillips and not wanting to do a custom cake. And it's interesting, if you don't know the details of this case, right? The gay couple that wanted the cake, they could come in and buy any of his pre-made cakes. He wasn't refusing them service. He was refusing to do custom design cake for them, and they sued him and have made his life very difficult for years. But that's a part of the for-profit religious idea of what you participate in. And there's creative elements, whether it's in photography or other sorts of things. And increasingly, we've seen, again, over the last 5 or 6 years, the idea of debanking and financial discrimination, particularly along religious lines. And so there's some debate about this in certain libertarian circles about how exactly to craft this. But the idea is that states can pass protections, and several have, saying that banks can't debank people because they disagree with their religious goals or convictions. So those are some economic life safeguards. Religious life, you would think that this would be prevalent everywhere, but it's not always. So the allowance of use of alcohol, serving minors, say in communion or other kinds of rituals, houses of worship protected from closing, as I mentioned, churches and clergy not having to participate in same-sex marriage ceremonies if they object to it on religious grounds, the confidentiality that Mark was alluding to. So we've got religious life. And then we have school and family life safeguards. And under school protections, there's quite a few different elements in terms of holidays, time off, what people are allowed to opt out of, and then the not allowing religious discrimination when it comes to parent eligibility. So these are just the list of the 20 safeguards we have. Going back 5 years ago, we had 12, and then it increased to 14, 16, so we're up to 20. So it's a growing project. We just finished, or are finishing year five here. Again, this is last year. In terms of improvements in the index, and I guess the numbering's off here, you have an index of 100, Idaho increased 7 points, Arizona 6, Montana 5. The top five states have varied a little bit over the years. So if you look in 2022, Mississippi was number one, and then we added a bunch of stuff to the index that Mississippi didn't have, so it dropped down to five there. Illinois was the top state in 23 and 24. This year it's number three. And notice the scores for Illinois, as I mentioned earlier, are beginning to decline as there are new threats to religious liberty, new ways that states are protecting religious liberty. Illinois is not adding those protections. And so its overall score has gone from 85 to 80 to 69%. And I believe it's a little bit lower for 2026 as well. I think I'm going to wrap up here and invite Mark back up in just a second. The one other thing that I'll say about this project before Mark kind of summarizes where we're going with it is I'll just mention, if this is of interest to you, like I said, we're finishing up year five. We're hoping to do like a paper workshop fall of next year. So not this fall, but the following one. So if you're interested in digging into the data, thinking about religious liberty issues, maybe as it relates to your discipline or a project you're working on, I or Mark or Jordan or others would be happy to talk with you to just kind of get the wheels turning. So we're thinking about putting this together to do kind of a small workshop on how we apply and can study our database here and cross-reference it with, say, studies of economic freedom or socioeconomic data and or migration trends. So we're wanting to think about how to expand or use this study in a variety of ways. So just mention that for now, and then I'll invite Mark back up here to give some concluding remarks about the study. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Paul. So I just have a few thoughts that I'll share about the study and then an ask of you all. A few thoughts. You mentioned before there has to be a limiting principle. And I think William Brennan's test that he came up with in 1963 is a pretty good one, that the state may, in fact, keep someone from acting on their religious convictions if the state has a compelling interest to do so, and they do so in the least intrusive means. So I think we all know that there's members of the First Church of Christ Science, a Christian scientist, who believe that basically all illness is spiritual and not physical. And so if a Christian scientist gets sick, he or she will not go and seek medical treatment. They will pray. And when it comes to adults, I'd say more power to you. It's not the decision I would make, but that's fine for you. But what about their children? Because Christian scientists don't want to bring their children to have medical treatment. Well, some states have, in fact, passed laws effectively requiring parents to get medical treatment for their children when it's reasonable and unusual. So we aren't talking about crazy experimental stuff, but, you know, penicillin for pneumonia or something like that. I would say that's a sort of law that is, it is limiting the religious liberty of the Christian scientist. But I think you can, at least to my way of thinking, there is a state compelling interest in protecting innocent children. And the state is pursuing that in the least intrusive means possible. They aren't taking the child away from the family, but they are saying to the family that you have to get medical treatment. And so there are a few categories of things that people want to do in the name of religion that we do think the state appropriately says, no, you can't do that, or yes, you must do that. I gave you one example. There's several others as well. Let me mention as well that we are crystal clear. One of the most ridiculous claims, and you see this all the time, of people on the left, especially of the Freedom From Religion Foundation and places like that, is they say groups like First Liberty, Alliance Defending Freedom, they're just concerned with protecting the religious liberty of Christians. absolutely false. I actually had an undergraduate student who went on and got a PhD, did a dissertation on 10 Christian legal advocacy groups. And what he found is 9 of the 10 all regularly defended non-Christians, filed briefs, represented, and so forth. The Thomas More Law Center is the only one that doesn't. And that's a choice they make, and that more power to them. But again, First Liberty and others don't make that decision. They understand that religious liberty is a right that all Americans enjoy. One of the things we've consciously attempted to do is find protections that are more likely to protect religious minorities than majorities. Paul alluded to a couple of these. Let me just highlight it. Even though we live maybe in a post-Christian society, the school year in most public schools still revolves around the Christian liturgical year. How many school districts have church on Sunday? We might call it winter break, but winter break conveniently lets Christians celebrate Christmas, right? On the other hand, if you're an Orthodox Jew, something like Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur may very well fall on a school day. Now, we would like to think that most school districts, most principals would work with such families and there wouldn't be a conflict, but we kind of like states that pass a law that basically say if a religious holiday falls on a school day, the school must give up to 3 excused absences per semester. There's also a law that requires athletic associations to allow students to wear religious garb if possible, if it's dangerous in sporting events. If it's dangerous, of course, you can prohibit it. But a Jewish, Orthodox Jewish young man wearing a yarmulke playing basketball would seem not to be a threat to anyone. Let me use that example to transition into why religious freedom restoration acts aren't all they're cracked up to be. Again, we have a little pamphlet where we say, these are the 5 most important statutes your state should have. If it doesn't have it, you should have it. And we do have a state Religious Freedom Restoration Act as the top suggestion. But again, it's not a cure-all. So even back in the 1980s, when the court was using this really nice test from William Brennan, there was a case of an Air Force psychologist who had a religious conviction that he had to wear the yarmulke. And the military said, no, the law is the law. We have uniform codes. You can't wear the yarmulke. This case was appealed, and it ultimately went to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court said, yeah, that's fine, military. There's a compelling interest in requiring everyone to look the same. That's a decision that we would disagree with. And that's a problem with the compelling interest test. Compelling interest may be in the eyes of the beholder. Fortunately, that's an area where Congress actually did stuff back in the day. You young people wouldn't recognize this. But Congress actually stepped up and passed an act requiring the military to make accommodations for religious garb whenever possible. Sometimes it's not possible, but I don't know of any good reason why a Jewish psychologist in the Air Force shouldn't be able to wear a yarmulke. I think he was based in Ohio. I mean, there's just no good reason behind that law. Similarly, we've seen on some of these wedding vendor cases. I was an expert witness in the Baronelle Stutzman case, the florist in Washington State who couldn't participate in a same-sex wedding ceremony. Now, Washington State has a constitutional free exercise clause provision that it still interprets using strict scrutiny. And so here this grandmother who knowingly and willingly served a same-sex couple for like 8 years, but she heard through the grapevine that they were going to ask her to custom design flowers for the wedding. She went home and prayed about it, and she concluded, I just can't do this. When one of the young men came in, she said, I know why you're here. I'm sorry. I can't do this. She gave him a hug. She referred this young man to 3 other florists that were perfectly happy to serve the couple. And in a world of consenting adults, that should have been the end of it, in my estimation. Unfortunately, the couple went to a party where they got talking to an ACLU attorney, and the ACLU said, this cannot be, and they brought ruinous lawsuits. The attorney general of the state, and really this should have been handled through other means, the state civil rights commission, but the attorney general of the state said, this cannot be, bringing suits. I was witnessing what was supposed to be a trial at a district court level, but the district court judge has issued a preliminary ruling and said, well, the law is clear. There's clearly a compelling interest in requiring this grandmother to custom design flowers for a same-sex wedding ceremony. And so therefore, she lost. And this case has been litigated up and down, up and down. But again, the problem, I like Religious Freedom Restoration Acts. I wish every state would have it. But again, there's too much discretion, I think, for judges, whereas a lot of our protections are really quite specific. Mississippi has a law, Arkansas now has a law, clearly stating that for-profit businesses cannot be compelled to engage in business that goes against their owner's religious convictions, a law that would protect a Baronel Stutzman or Jack Phillips if it was present in those states. And I think it's real hard for a judge to get around a law that so clearly limits a person. Well, this brings me to the ask. You all come from a variety of states. As far as I know, you all are from various American states. As Paul suggested, this is a serious academic study, but we also are trying to use it to advocate for religious liberty. Nathaniel and I are participating in an event in Dayton, where, frankly, we're hoping to convince legislators in Ohio to adopt a Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Think about that. 29 states have Religious Freedom Restoration Acts. Those that don't are primarily the deepest of blue states. Ohio's a red state, and it doesn't have a Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And so, in part, we'll present this study and some other arguments to try to convince people to get going for the very reason that Paul suggested. Ohio might be a really friendly environment right now, but who knows where it will be in 20 years, and it'll be real nice if it has a Religious Freedom Restoration Act in place. One of the things we do in our study, you have a paper version here, you can go to it online, and you'll find links to every single law that we include in the study. And we're now up to 50 individual laws, 20 safeguards, but some of the safeguards have multiple what we call items or protections. And so let's say you're chatting with a legislator who said, well, that's a kind of cool idea to protect for-profit businesses from having to engage in activities that go against their owner's convictions. I'd like to introduce such a law. Well, that person could easily go to Mississippi, click on the link, see what that law looks like, and use it as a basis for a law. They wouldn't have to cut and paste it, but they could use it as a basis for crafting a law in their state. And so we are very actively interested in going out to the states and talking with people, talking with them over Zoom, showing up in person. We're obviously connected with First Liberty, so neither Paul nor I are attorneys, but we could easily get a First Liberty attorney to show up and provide legal testimony or advice if that is so desired. So please, if you know people, a legislator or a head of a state policy think tank or something like that, that might be interested in this, take a copy of the report. We have a few extras here. Put them in contact with Paul or me or Jordan or Drew or any of the crew from the Center for Religion, Culture, and Democracy, which is a part of First Liberty, would be perfectly happy to go pretty much anywhere to advocate for religious liberty. So thank you all very much.
You have been listening to The Sower, a production of the Ciceronian Society. To learn more about us, our programs, and to sign up for our newsletter, please visit ciceroniansociety.org.